Our gospel lesson is from the book of Matthew, chapter 2, verses 13 through 23. Now after they, the Magi, had left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you. For Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, he was infuriated. And he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children, she refused to be consoled because they are no more. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. He will be called a Nazarene. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. King Herod the Great was a Roman client king of Judea. About a century before this story, the Hasmonean kings of Judah conquered Idumea, formerly called Edom, and forced everyone to become Jewish. Herod was an Idumean whose family worked their way into power during the typical power struggles associated with the Roman Empire. Basically, they chose the right people to support, first Julius Caesar, then Mark Antony. Herod ended up as king by winning a 3-year war against the last Hasmonean. He was raised as a Jew, but many saw Herod and his family as half-Jewish because the Idumeans had only been Jewish for a century, and Herod didn't act particularly Jewish. His rule was brutal, even compared to his contemporaries. He employed a secret police force to monitor public opinion and root out subversives. He killed several of his sons and one of his wives in an effort to maintain his power. In the verses just before today's lesson, the Holy Family was visited by the Magi. These were foreigners, astrologers, and likely Zoroastrian priests. They were wise men, I suppose, but they did one stupid thing. They visited King Herod and asked him where a baby was who would one day become king of the Jewish nation. Of course, Herod responded with deceit and dealt in bad faith. He had no intention of tolerating a rival to the throne, not within his own family, so certainly not from a peasant. The Magi wisely paid attention to their dream and avoided Herod after visiting Jesus. The story turns now to Joseph. He was the son of Jacob and had multiple dreams in which an angel of the Lord visited him. Now, does that sound familiar? This whole sequence is written to mirror the story in Genesis and Exodus. In Genesis, we hear of Joseph, son of Jacob, whose life was in danger after he told his brothers about some dreams. He was sent to Egypt, a trip that ultimately saved him, his family, and the entire nation of Israel. Our Joseph, husband of Mary, is warned in a dream to flee to Egypt to save our Savior. Jesus then is shown to parallel Moses. In Moses' time, Pharaoh decreed that all Israelite newborn boys would be killed, just as Herod decreed for the babies of Bethlehem. Like Jesus, Moses had parents who defied the ruler and saved his life. Moses was the archetypal leader, a prophet who spoke to God and brought God's message to the people, as well as a general and civil administrator. His successor was Joshua, a general. It's not obvious in English, but actually Jesus and Joshua are essentially the same name. In Hebrew, they're Yeshua and Yehoshua, both meaning God saves. In New Testament times, there was a return to those old Torah names, reflecting a desire for a new independent nation whose only sovereign was God. Jesus was a relatively common name, as were Joseph, Mary, and Jacob. Perhaps Jesus' parents thought their son would grow up to be like his ancient namesake, a great leader who would restore the Jewish nation. Well, maybe Herod thought so too. He reacts the only way he knew how: murder. In an event sometimes called the Slaughter of the Innocents, he decreed the death of many babies and toddlers, a brutality by any standard. This raises the question of theodicy. Why does God allow bad things to happen? Why does God allow evil? Why did God send an angel to warn Jesus' parents and not the other parents whose families would suffer? Well, spoiler alert, I haven't solved the theodicy problem. Greater minds than mine have meditated on it for at least 2,000 years now and have only found partial answers. In this particular case, I can offer two answers. One is that Jesus was not saved for his own sake, nor for a life of ease, but for a life of suffering and service to the greater good. This was the first time, but not the last, that he was threatened by the civil authorities because of his place in history. What Herod failed to accomplish, Pontius Pilate completed. The second answer is that we're asking the wrong question. Instead of asking why God allows evil, we should ask, why do we? Why did Herod kill all those children in addition to his own sons? Why did the power structures of the world allow him to do so? In America, we have this idea that the written rules of law govern what happens and that decisions are based on fairness. In Herod's Judea, though, government was buttressed by fear and power. Nobody dared oppose Herod for fear of their lives. Herod sought to kill Jesus because Jesus was the rightful heir to the throne, the anointed leader of the Jews. Where fairness might say that Jesus should be celebrated, nurtured, and groomed to inherit the throne, the rules of fear and power said that Jesus must die. Fortunately, Joseph stepped in. He had already risked his social standing by staying engaged to a pregnant virgin, and now he was asked to risk his life for her and her child. We heard last week, though, that he was a righteous man, and so he obeyed God's messengers. As a craftsman, he didn't have land, so he was free to move wherever he chose. He could ply his trade elsewhere. Just like Chris Christopherson said, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. He was free. He had no home, no land, no social standing, nothing but his new wife and baby. And so he fled to Egypt to save the little he had left. Why Egypt? At the time, there was a significant Jewish diaspora in Egypt already. Maybe a third of Alexandria was Jewish, the largest population outside Judea. It might be like a Russian or German Jew fleeing to New York or Chicago in the first part of the 20th century. Indeed, Joseph's family was far from the first or last Jewish refugees. The other night, Sam convinced us all to watch Fiddler on the Roof, set in about 1905 in Russia. There were a lot of historical inaccuracies, but one thing they got right was the tension between Jews in their confined villages and the general Russian population. Pogroms in that era killed about 1,000 Jews and injured another 7,000 to 8,000. At that time, a majority of the world's Jews actually lived inside Russia's borders for two reasons. One, Russia kept annexing places where Jews lived. And two, various parts of Western Europe had been expelling Jews for 1,000 years, leaving Poland, Ukraine, and adjoining territories as the most hospitable. But then the Russian Empire became inhospitable, so Jews were back on the road. Those who remained in Central Europe were subject to the Holocaust a generation later. Anti-Semitism is still alive and well today. Just Friday, there was a story on the news about the rise of anti-Semitic hate crimes, at least 6 in New York City in the past week. Today, we see people all around the world who need a safe place to go. In much of the world, violence or the threat of violence are the dominant form of government. We read about refugee crises in Yemen and Syria due to wars. We read about ethnic cleansing in Myanmar, putting the Rohingya at risk. We hear about the Northern Triangle of Central America, which is run by gangs and drug cartels. In these places and others, the strong prey on the weak. People have few choices: fight against the powerful and die, submit to the powerful and suffer, or flee to uncertainty. Some parents trade their own safety for that of their children. Others don't even have that choice. They need a Joseph to save them. Jesus may save their soul, but who will save their lives? Here in our own community, most of us don't have to deal with such major fears. Unfortunately, some people do. Ashley Brooks, executive director of the mission, recently told me she was getting trained to deal with sex trafficking. The difference between prostitution and sex trafficking is largely one of perspective. The fact is, in most cases, the woman involved is the victim, not the criminal. For example, in 2017, police raided a home in Columbia, just off Van Diver Drive. A minor who was missing from a Wisconsin home was found there, being forced into sex in what turned out to be a decades-long trafficking hub. Most of the other stories I've read involved an acquaintance, a friend, or even a family member enabling a trafficker to force a woman into sex work, either because of a threat of violence or for money. Statistics I read indicated that most victims are aged 12 to 14 at the start, and that 80% of teens who run away from home are approached by a trafficker or predator within 48 hours. Ashley said she pursued the training in part because it's happening here. She told me about two recent cases in Rolla. The mission is in a prime position to help, but of course, a smart criminal would avoid being noticed. It is incumbent on us all to be aware of the dangerous people in this world and to notice and to help those who are being victimized. Coming a little closer to home, we all have certain fears about the future. At the most fundamental level, we fear death, our own or someone in our family. I think all of our fears ultimately come back to fearing death, but there's more. We fear poor health. Some diseases seem worse than death, like some forms of dementia. We have financial fears, running out of money before we die, or losing our homes. We fear losing our relationships, letting our family disintegrate. And we have more mundane fears, like fear of embarrassment. We also have fears that if we try to do the right thing, it will blow back on us. For example, going back to the sex trafficking issue, if we see something disconcerting and alert law enforcement, we may need to invest a lot of our time and energy to seeing the case through, and we may end up becoming a target for violence ourselves. It's a scary world out there. Well, I think some worries are reasonable. Like Yogi Berra said, making predictions is hard, especially about the future. If we don't think about our futures at least a little bit, we may not have a future to worry about. If we never think about consequences, we can easily put ourselves in danger. But ultimately, we need to trust that we are in God's hands. So let's turn to the epistle reading, specifically Hebrews 2, verses 14 and 15. It said, "Since therefore the children share flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared the same things, so that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by the fear of death." Jesus came to be among us in the flesh to enter into life and therefore to enter into death. By entering in, he was able to defeat death. Now, we may still worry about losing people to death or worry that we won't finish our life's work, but we have no need to fear death. Jesus came to set us free so that we may live boldly. We are not only free from fear, but also free to love. Free to give, free to share, free to speak boldly, free to live our best lives. If God is with us, who can stand against us? I often counsel my graduate students to fail aggressively. That is, there's two ways to fail. One is, you try something and it doesn't work. The other is to worry that you'll make a mistake, or that you'll look foolish, or that your idea is no good, or whatever, and so you don't even try. But although only a fraction of the proposals I've submitted were accepted, none of the ones that I didn't submit got funded. None of the papers that I didn't submit were published. None of the experiments that I didn't run worked. God gave us a great gift in the person of Jesus. He demonstrated a life with maybe a little worry and planning, but no fear. He knew where his path would lead and planned his ministry accordingly. He seemed to worry that he wouldn't get his message across to the disciples before he was killed. They did seem a little thick sometimes. But Jesus lived without fear. He spoke forthrightly against the power structures at the time, even knowing that he was risking his life. So I ask myself, what should I be doing differently, knowing that I have nothing to fear? How should I be seeking to build God's kingdom? Who should I be willing to talk to about the gospel? What project or program should I be undertaking to serve God's people? I have a few answers, but I acknowledge that I need to move from should be doing to am doing. It's hard to move past the fear. I pray for the strength and courage to follow where God is leading me. Joseph was willing to marry a woman who was already pregnant, raise a son not his own, flee to Egypt, and relocate to Nazareth. I should at least be willing to strike up a conversation about God's love. What about you? What about us? What should we as a church be doing to build God's kingdom? Let's figure it out and then move forward without fear, knowing that Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us. Amen.